You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to Tim Key, who is an absolute fringe pioneer and is an incredibly talented comic and writer, and is probably responsible for some of the most startling theatrical comedy moments of the last few fringes I've been to. Really just has an absolutely breathtaking vision for what comedy can be. So here's Tim Key, and listen out for a big announcement coming up in the middle section of the show. I'll speak to you then. Here's Tim Key.
So we were discussing the nerve centre. Just, I mean, could you just describe what we're looking at here for the listener?
Okay, well, so what we've got is, I guess this is my, this is the nerve centre. I guess it was a bedroom, but it's quite small, but it's now a study.
Yes, and it's, I'm sitting on a rich red leather sofa.
Oxblood. oh my God. That's an oxblood sofa, mate. Actually, less comfortable than I thought it would be because I put it online. The cushions will feel free to sometimes readjust yourself.
I will. They quite
slide you forward.
Yeah. Will they? I was thinking the noise.
You keep sliding forward, and it keeps making it look like you're interested in what I'm saying.
Yeah, perfect. and then you've got some of that paint that you can chalk on.
Yeah, I heard about the paint and painted. I suppose what I've got there is on that wall. I suppose that's sort of a hero wall. It's got a
yes.
It's got two pillars of black, one of which has got my 5K times from 2013 on.
Okay.
And the other of which has got ideas for writing a column. But actually, I haven't touched that for maybe about 18 months. And the only reason that I did now is because you told me to close the door.
Yeah, I see it's behind the door, isn't it?
that door's been open for about a while now.
Oh, shit, I've not done a 5K in ages.
That's why I'm like, it suddenly hammers home the fact that I'm fat. Oh, it's because that door was open.
That's incredible.
Yeah, because that's it. 2013, 15th of June, 22nd of June, 29th of June. That was every week I did it in June 2013. And now it's, that's the elephant in the room, really. It's March 2015, and I can't do 5Ks anymore.
Oh, well, you never know. We might move another item of furniture and discover more positive things.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
but you've got the lists of things. You've got a poem written above
poem.
The keyboard.
Yeah.
I just like people to imagine this.
Yeah.
And over the top of the wall there are and this is one of the things I love seeing in stand-up comics.
I suppose some have them and some don't.
Some people have them, some people don't. Just posters from previous shows, which is lovely.
I have them.
Yeah, you've got them.
Couple of reasons for that. Happy memories. Shows. Very happy. And secondly,
very well
designed.
Really
like the posters.
They're great posters.
That's the thing. Yeah.
And then there are post-it notes of various colours all over the walls, all over most of the walls. And behind me, a huge corkboard with. And I should say, we've never done this before. This is how I imagined when I started doing this podcast, as I say, nearly 3 years ago, or maybe more than 3 years ago. I kind of imagined that
it would be like
most
this.
Comics would be like this. Absolutely no one
is. You finally found one.
Yeah, absolutely, at last. So there's a cork board full of, and obviously these are playing cards that you use in the show.
They're pornographic playing cards, let's not beat around the bush.
On the faces of which are cut out printed bits of...
Yeah, well, it depends how you mean by faces. I mean, I think I would probably say backs.
The backs are surely the bit that's all the same in the deck of cards.
Which is what these are on.
Oh, is that right? Oh, because the faces are pornographic and you want the audience to see the pornographic bit.
Little treat, isn't it? It's not that I don't have faith in my material. Sometimes if it's falling a bit flat, you can at least sort of wriggle your card around
it. Nudie lady at people. Yeah, lovely. And is this an existing show or is this a show that you're making? What are we looking at?
I just started to... The cogs have just started to whir again, literally today, I think. As in, last night I did a new material night, and I hadn't done that for... I did my show, my last show, and I finished that in about... finished my tour in about October, November. Then I was doing something else, and so I hadn't started my new thing since then. So actually... coming into this room is sort of, it is a little bit like that, like the Marie Celeste, as in it's all sort of, it's the creative hub of something somewhere in 2013, I think.
Gotcha. Okay.
So what's up there is there's a show all about India on the left.
Yes.
And then on the right, where it starts getting, where you really get the impression that that is someone who's running out of ideas and so using a lot of stationery.
there are vertical lines of string dividing space on a massive corkboard.
There literally are. So I guess I'm the sort of comedian who sort of goes and buys string and then sort of takes it from there. So I've separated half the corkboard. And you've got to remember this big corkboard. This corkboard is huge.
This
cost me about the best part of £70. I mean, it's an impressive piece, but it's genuinely useful. And it's about 6x4, is it? Something like that, 5x3. It's pretty big. Anyway, that half there is my last, I suppose you'd call it Edinburgh show.
Yes.
Single white slut. And so each of those sections is... a third of the show.
Gotcha.
And each of the big cards is a poem or some kind of anecdote I was regaling on stage. And then each of the tiny ones just has phrases like sleep naked.
Yes, and girl in.
And Alba. And I think that was what was happening was when I was coming back after doing a work in progress, I would write down any new things and then put that onto a tiny card. And then put that onto this board.
So, should I deduce from this that the moment in this show or the previous show, maybe in Master Slut, when you put on the projector, you deconstructed a poem and showed all the different versions, the different drafts?
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm watching that thinking, how many of these are real and how many of these are a joke about the fact that Here's something simple that tumbled out, and now here's an enormous, like there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of like flickering on the screen versions of different drafts of the poem.
Yeah, yeah.
I had previously assumed that was a joke, and now I look at something as methodical as this, and I go, God, maybe he does 1,000 drafts of each one.
No, this has got nothing to do with drafting. This has got everything to do with ordering, and because that's the hardest thing about a show, I think, is for me. Like, I write a lot of poems, and so that's all fine, that's sort of taken care of. That's probably something where the way I've ended up with my sort of thing I do, that's one of my great bits of luck, that I now have these poems, which are not really, to be fair to them, rocket science. I would say maximum each one is a first draft. Some is clearly not even a draft yet, but you read it out and see what happens. But no, in terms of like, but there is a lot of, you know, real anal, there's a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably the same with most comedians. There's sort of a fine line between actual work and setting aside time, which I'm very good at setting aside time, but then very good at wasting that time.
Yes.
So, but I do feel like, I don't know, the harder I strain myself to try and make something work, the more likely it is to work. But I don't think those two things have got any correlation. It's not because I think of how it's going to work. It's because I think that there's some kind of, higher being sort of thinking, well, fair play, he's trying his hardest, so we'll throw him a bit of luck.
Yeah, okay.
Later on down the route.
Okay.
So by the end of a show, by the end of putting a show together, it feels like it sort of has a beginning, middle and an end. But it's not because I've spent hours and hours and hours working that out, exactly that structure. That sort of comes by obviously doing it again and again in, you know, work in progress and previewing it and working out that some bits don't work. And then something comes to you that kind of you think, oh, yeah, that's going to fit in. But, you know, still means you... I still think you have to sort of do something at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
is that when you work? Is that the...
Well, at daytime? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at 4 in the afternoon, I was gigging with Michael Fabry last night in Belfast, with the Belfast Empire. And we were just talking about the different times of day that we... Because I'm like this even when I'm not recording people.
Yeah.
But I have to make myself work first thing in the morning. I have to get up and write. It's otherwise, definitely the best time. I don't do it. But you're like an afternoon...
It can happen at any time. It's sort of desperation, isn't it? I often like, you know, I'll have a whole day, but the thing about having a whole day is it's a mixed blessing because you kind of look at it and you think, well, in that case, we can sort of gradually ease into this.
Okay.
And so it gets to about 11 and you sort of think, well, it's fine though, because I've got the whole day. So you can then find yourself sort of having lunch and thinking, well, this is going to be a pretty spicy afternoon for my show now. And then it'll get to 3 and at that point you think, right. Then you start looking backwards and think, right, that's about 7 hours I've wasted. So I need to very quickly write a poem about a man who falls in love with his bicycle or something. Otherwise, this won't have been a good day. So yeah, I would say in the afternoon... There's more sort of panic stations.
And do you find it easier to write when you've got a new material gig that night? Or is it out of a sense of not wanting to have wasted that day?
If I've got
a gig, then I can go, oh, God, it's a different kind of writing for me, because I go, this has to work tonight.
Yeah. The older I get, the more surprisingly close the deadline can come. And you just think, I think before... a deadline will be approaching it, and exactly that, you'd get the fear. And I kind of feel like sometimes that happens, and other times it would be remarkable to the point where I'd be thinking, well, you're on in an hour, so you need to sort of work that out. And then think, yeah, but I can sort of do it when I get there to an extent. And then sometimes you can sort of go on and just think, oh, I don't think there was ever a bit where I worked out that I had to get this thing done. And particularly on stage, it's a bit different, because if it's a new material thing, you know, who's to say whether it's better to be more prepared or less prepared? When it's your show and you're all done, then somehow you have put a lot of hours into your show and you have done it on stage a lot and it has all sort of come together. But I don't know, like I did a new material night last night and I was trying to work out what the best method was, whether it was best to know exactly what I was going to do or whether it was best just to have 10 new poems and read them out and see what happened.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that's how I used to do it when I first started doing it. That's why I really like starting again is a nice thing. It's quite liberating. Because when I first started, when anyone first starts, you don't have anything. And so you've got less stuff to choose from. And that can be quite a freeing thing.
Okay.
Because after a while, I've got 2,000 poems, like, floating around. And so to suddenly have a rule imposed where you're not going to do any you've done before, that's quite good, I think. And it also gives you a bit of nerves, because you're sort of going, well, obviously the main problem with that approach is that this might all be absolute feces. but it probably it'll be fine, because it's, you know, it's your stuff. And the ones that aren't going so well, that's okay. Sort of discuss that with the audience.
I was really interested to see. Oh God, there's loads of different directions we can go with this. I was really interested to see. I was doing some research and I saw a video on YouTube from 2005 of you reading some poems to someone that may or may not have been Alex Horn. I was trying to work out.
Yeah, very well have been Alex
Horn. Yeah, okay, to Alex Horn.
Yeah.
And it was really, because I'll be totally honest about this, I was watching loads of your stuff and I was reading about and remembering about, you know, reading reviews and being reminded of stuff. And I'm such a huge, huge fan of your work. And like I was saying, you know, bits of your work have kind of filtered into mine and my friends and my partner's kind of conversations.
Well, quite right.
Yeah. And I was, I suppose, at just at that point of going, oh, God, I think, you know, I often get like this with certain of my guests during the research things. It's just my approach to comedy. Yeah. I just want all of it. Anytime I see a thing, I go, God, I wish I was doing that. It's pathetic. But I was just reaching the kind of the peak of, oh, God, I think Tim Key is the person I'm most jealous of in the whole world. And then I saw the video of you in 2005 doing poems that didn't particularly make me laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And I went, oh, yes, because he wasn't born Tim Key the poet with all of this material and ability and experience.
No, I was born, well, terrible, useless, tiny. It took ages to deteriorate to this. Yeah, those ones were done in... that was a very strange thing was happening there. That was in Alex Horn's garden. And I think what had happened is I'd said to my friend that I'd record the audio of some poems. Then he would animate a... he'd build a head.
Okay.
I don't understand. I never understood. I had a lot of meetings. He'd build a head and he'd then make... an app. I mean, this is 10 years ago.
This is 10 years ago. That's early app chat. Yeah.
Yeah, but he's quite early app chat type person. And so he said, "Yeah, can you just record some, and then I'll do my bit, as in learn how to build a head, and learn how to do all that." So I just went into Alex is like a bit like you, you know, he has like these things, and like he can record things.
Yeah,
it's like a proper person. Yeah. Skills to do these things.
Yeah, all of this gear was given to me. Like someone said, buy exactly this, this, and this, and this.
Yeah, totally.
But I think Alex is far more natural at kind of.
But the point is, both of you can sort of use phrases like "give me a minute, I'll set up."
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah.
I really relish saying that because it's a very recent thing.
Yeah, yeah.
This little thing that I'm kind of my backup recorder I'm using here. That's the one that I done. You know, I did about 75 episodes.
Oh, right.
So me setting up was just pressing that button.
Oh, wow. That's good, isn't
it? I'm really relishing these days going, Tim, I'll just set up.
Yeah, I love
fiddling it. Fiddling with cables, tell me what you had for breakfast.
Oh, totally. Well, I definitely sensed that you were sort of slowing down so that when I came into the room, you were still setting up. Anyway, I went into Alex. When I had to record these poems, I couldn't set up, so I had to go to Alex Horn's garden, and just read out about 20 poems. And you're right, I've seen that since. I think it starts with me starting to read and then sort of going, can you come back? Because he was going to just leave me to it, I think. And I was just I was going to read them out. And then I thought, I can't do that. And then he came back, and then it was sort of, I think it was a better method of doing it, reading like that. But still, it had its downsides, as in I'd finish a poem, and exactly as you've said, they weren't necessarily that funny. But I'd finish one and Alex would say, right, is that it? And I go, yep, yes, that's it.
Something that's so delicious about watching your work now is the fractured nature of the poems, the fact that they are kind of like jazz, you know, they kind of, that suddenly stops, oh, it's over. We know it's over because we're laughing, but presumably in the creative process, there are moments where they don't get laughs.
Yeah.
And do you find yourself thinking, is this poem over? Is it finished? Is it good?
Yeah,
will it be good?
There's quite a few that have there's none, I don't think, that lengthen in performance. Oh, well, there's a few little, I'll add a few words in sometimes because I do genuinely read them. So there's sometimes bits where I'll just throw a word in maybe, but there's definitely poems where they find their length and they're cut during performance, like that, you know, like a 6-line poem can sometimes. There's one I used to do where it says, I know how it starts. It goes, Tanya Googled herself, still nothing. And then that always used to get a laugh because. Yeah.
It tells the whole story.
Yeah, it's all done. Yeah. It's all done. And I think after that, I can't remember what she does, But I seem to remember she has some cereal or something, and she's, I think she's at her desk, and then I think she clicks refresh, and it's still not happening. And, yeah, that was the poem I wrote.
Yeah.
And yet the first time I did it, it was clear to me that that was that done. And then that became a kind of, yeah, like, you know, got found its place into my Edinburgh show and stuff, and became one that I would lean very heavily on.
Well, it's perfect, really, because it's so small. It's like a one-liner, it's like a rescue one-liner almost.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, there are some that are like that. And, yeah, I'm sure it's the same with people who write jokes and things, or, you know, there are times where you write one and you just sort of think, yeah, that's... That, like you say, it's the whole story is told very economically, and so yeah, there are a few like that. There's somewhere I'll do the first line, and even if it's like last night when I was doing them, somewhere I just do the first line and then throw it down. But it can be for a variety of reasons. It can be that I completely have lost faith in the idea of someone licking his crash helmet being funny. There's somewhere people enjoy the name of the person, and we all enjoy it for a bit, and then it goes. There's obviously somewhere I sort of read ahead and think, well, that's not going to get any better. Not that it's hit a height,
okay.
But just more, that's not getting any better.
Yeah, okay. And do you have the option to, I suppose it depends on the gig, but do you have the option to switch the order around? I mean, are you looking at them and genuinely making decisions going, that won't work here, drop it?
Yeah, I have options. So I'm not sort of unionised. I can do what I want. still very much down to me. I can. If it's again, it's like a difference between a show and a new material situation. In a show, I'm really quite disciplined, I think, in a show where there's tons of room to sort of play around and things, but it's always the same order. Partly because I kind of feel that I don't want to sort of chop and change too much, because though I might write while I'm doing the show, I don't want to put something in and then it be a show that gradually turns into my next show. I want it to be a show that then stops and has a final night.
Okay.
And then a new one that starts.
Okay.
But in my last show, I had a bit where I'd get someone up on stage and we go through some new stuff. And that was quite... it was a slightly strange show to develop, because it happened in a... in a sort of weird way compared to the other ones. And so I had this bit in Edinburgh, because it was advertised as work in progress in Edinburgh, because it was a work in progress. So I wanted it to... I wanted to be have that freedom to make it a bit different every night. But that stayed in once it... You know, when I was on tour, that I'd just have someone up on my bed and we'd just be going through these poems and reading them to one another. And that's quite a fun thing to have, because it... Obviously, anything that keeps your show... interesting for you is quite good.
Yes.
But usually I do have that sort of... there's a split between the two things. A show is a show.
Okay.
And then new material. Yeah, absolutely. Yesterday I had all of them in my hand. And... But then again, you know, there's a certain amount of good sense in... If you've got 40 poems on the way to a gig, you may as well, if you're not doing anything else on the bus, choose which ones you think are your favourite 12 then. And then that might change when you're just about to go on. You just think, well, that one's much better than that one. Or you just think, well, why am I reading that? So that can happen. But yeah, by and large, you want to know that you're taking your favourite ones.
So this is Tim. I hope you're enjoying this. I mentioned there's a big announcement coming up. A tiny bit of admin first. A couple of gigs, which it's preview week for me next week. I ran about this time last year. I was at the New Zealand Comedy Festival, give or take a month, and really enjoyed the opportunity to be working on a preview show every night and then going away and writing it, rewriting all day. And I've tried to recreate this in the UK. So next week on the 17th, I've got a preview at Top Secret Comedy Club in Drury Lane. That's thetopsecretcomedyclub.co.uk. On the 18th, I'm at Backyard Comedy Club in Bethnal Green with Joe Lycett and Julian Dean, who, I mean, that's a storming lineup. What a bunch of nice, funny people that is. And on the 19th, myself and Joe Lycett are doing another doubleheader preview at the Pleasance in Islington. So do come along to one of those if you like. The Top Secret one is cheap. The Backyard one is free. We'll do a donation collection at the end, and the Pleasance will cost you a few pounds, but it'll be worth it. It's a very lovely theatre. I'm doing the live podcast and a solo preview. preview at a couple of festivals coming up end of April. I'm in Tallinn in Estonia for the Estonian Comedy Festival. So if you're listening in Estonia, do come along to that. And at the beginning of May, I'm doing the same, a solo preview and a live podcast with one guest at the secret Welsh festival we don't talk about. So if you know what that is, have a look for details on that. Book your tickets now and I'll see you there. Now, over the last few shows, I've occasionally tantalisingly mentioned updates and big news on the way, and here is some of it. I am very, very pleased and proud to announce that I have a run at the Soho Theatre of live podcasts. The Comedian's Comedian is coming to the Soho Theatre for 4 months, the first, not 4 months in a row, let's take it easy, baby steps. It's the first Tuesday of the month, so that's the 7th of April, the 5th of May, the 2nd of June and the 7th of July. Tickets are on sale now from sohotheatre.com and all those shows are at 9:30 p.m. So if you fancy one of those, and obviously everyone, I announced this yesterday on Twitter, on the Facebook group, but obviously everyone's going, who are the guests, who are the guests? As soon as I know who the guests are, you will know who the guests are. There's a number of very exciting conversations going on at the moment, but I certainly will not. I'm not going to tell you who it is until they're absolutely confirmed. Rest assured, those will all be loads of fun. We're going to do a ticket deal for ComCom listeners, so listen out for that. Or if you want to jump in there first, they're not expensive anyway. Go to sohotheatre.com and we're under T for The Comedian's Comedian Podcast with Stuart Goldsmith. So do look out for those and tell everybody about those. Very, very excited and very keen to make those a big success. My first dip into a relationship with the Soho Theatre, which is just, I mean, a lot of these, you'll have heard me say on previous episodes, a lot of these guests, I've seen their work at Soho or I've advertised them at Soho. In fact, coming up on, I think, the 20th and 21st of March, I'm sure it is, that's in just in a couple of weeks, you must not miss Joel Dommett's show, Finding Nemo, which is a show about how he used to be a goth and he's tried to put his old goth band back together while suffering a midlife crisis as an adult. It contains my favourite joke of the whole of Last Fringe, and that is worth the entrance fee alone, so don't miss that. That's at the Soho. A perfectly good example there. They're not giving me any money, incidentally. It's just that they are the powerhouse of theatre, of comic theatre and comedy in the UK. In London, they are the people that bring over international acts, I think, with more regularity than anyone else. There's some brilliant venues in London, but the Soho have a very special relationship with comedy, and I'm very excited to be part of that. Thank you for your donations, of course. Thank you to David Hall, who came up to me at my preview at the Phoenix Fringe and pressed a generous amount of cash into my hand. You can do that if you don't want to pay the PayPal charges. I mean, you don't pay them. I pay them from your donations. But if you don't want me to pay the PayPal charges, you can just come up to me, find me at a gig, pounce on me as David did, and thrust some notes into my hand. I'll be very, very grateful. But if you'd rather pay online, or if you're somewhere inconvenient, or somewhere that you would find inconvenient to come and do that, you can, of course, click on the extremely visible. Do you know, I looked for it again recently. It does take a while to find. I've done a 180 on this. The donate button is on the right-hand sort of top right corner of the screen at comedianscomedian.com and down a bit. So thanks to David Hall. And thank you, and a big shout out to Alex Kendall, finally, before we get back to Tim. He is a recovery driver, and he collected brilliant comedian and my dear friend George Egg when George's van broke down in Brighton. And then George got in, like, George was texting me from the van going, oh God, what a disaster, having to get recovered. I used to have a VW van as well. I've sidestepped to a Mazda Bongo, and the fucker drives. So I'm very excited about that. George is one of those people who bakes his own bread and brews his own beer and makes incredible, incredible comedy props for his brilliant visual stage show, which he's also taking for the first time at the Edinburgh Festival this year. Anarchist Cook, don't miss that. George got into Alex Kendall's recovery van, and I was the last person he texted about his woes about getting recovered. And then Alex Kendall apparently said, do you mind if I put something on the radio? And he put on this podcast. So thank you so much. A lovely weird moment for George there. And a big shout out to Alex. Thank you very much for helping him out. And lots of love to van recovery drivers everywhere. That's all for now. A little bit more, a little advert, some special treat freebies available for you, or discounts, I should say, in the final blurb. Let's get back to Tim Key.
I just want to sort of press pause on the poems and on the writing process for the moment, because I've got loads more to ask about it. But I also feel like I want to go back and see how you started, because I remember running into you at gigs years ago when you were doing, you were just starting doing lager in a suit,
right?
You know, and spilling lager on yourself and things like that. And I know as well that you, before that, you were in Cowards, which I never saw live, but I've seen online. So there's loads of stuff to talk about on the way. And then We Need Answers, rolling forward and falling off a chair and things like this. Before all of that, you have something I'm fond of talking about in the show is people's origin stories. And I know you've told this story a lot before. I've heard it in a lot of different contexts. But you have one of the most ridiculous origin stories. The whole pretending to be at Cambridge to get into Footlights.
Yeah.
Now, I know you've told that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want you to retread ground you've done. But if you could, if you just explain what happened in two sentences, then I've got questions about why it happened.
Well, I think what happened is... Okay, so I think what happened was I finished my degree... And went home to live in, I guess quite fortunately, a village near Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was working out what to do next. And I decided I wanted to do a bit of acting or something. I quite like the idea of doing that. This isn't two sentences. And then I auditioned for, I decided it would be a bit, you know, it didn't really appeal to do amateur dramatics because I felt like, well, I basically thought if I could get into the student side of things, that's more interesting because everyone's young, everyone's the same as what I've just finished at mm-hmm. Sheffield University. So I thought maybe there's a version of that. So I auditioned for something called Bouncers by John Godber, and I auditioned for the pantomime, Cambridge Footlights pantomime. And as part of that, I think in both cases I had to pretend that I was a student. So I auditioned for the pantomime, written by Alex Horn, amazingly. Mm-hmm. And I had to write down my email address, and there was A4 sheets of email addresses, lots of them. And on the front sheet there was 12 or 15 already down, all of them with the same format. I think they all ended .com or .ac .com or something. So I put mine in, timkey5@hotmail.com. It's not my email anymore. And they said, oh, right, okay. Have you not got a college one? And I said, no, that's their... my college one hasn't come through, which I don't know what that means. I thought I'd heard someone say something like that once.
Yeah.
You get things coming through, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So my college one hadn't come through. Then I auditioned, and then I got into the pantomime, and that was my sort of I guess my foot in the door.
Given that what you're effectively doing, like given the reputation of Cambridge Footlights as being a way into comedy,
yeah,
and the legacy, the dynasty, if you like, of all that of that organisation. It seems to me incredibly fortuitous that you wandered into it.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of makes me think, like, whenever I've heard the story before, I've thought, clever bastard.
Not really.
Were you really that blind?
No, there's a few things about it which are... It wasn't at all calculated because I didn't have any idea that I wanted to be a comedian. Obviously, I was still in that mindset of thinking that, you know, when someone says, what do you want to do when you're older? When you're little, you say a footballer or, you know, whatever, racing car driver. And then after that, you get into, I don't know, like you're sort of brainwashed into thinking that those things, are not, that there's things that's impossible and there's things that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was 22, 23, and just totally thinking, I don't know, journalism. Law conversion was my mum's catchphrase at the time. There's all sorts of things like that which are jobs which you can get. And so when I auditioned, I wasn't thinking in any way that it was... I didn't even think it was to do with comedy. I just thought it was to do with wanting to be on stage and be in a play one more time and then start my career. That was what I was doing.
Okay.
But but right after getting into it, I then... I got into this pantomime, and I really liked it. It was really fun, really dynamic, interesting, nice people.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And I guess even though I'd done loads of like plays and things at university, it just felt a little bit different. And from there, I auditioned for a sketch show, which I kind of then did a bit of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, this all happened in about 4 months, there was the Footlights Tour show. And that's what you're talking about.
Okay.
The Footlights Tour show, that's the one that goes to Edinburgh, and that's the one where I guess you trace it back each year, and sure, each time there's five or six comedians who... But, I mean, I kind of very across it now, and I think I vaguely knew... I mean, I knew Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. I loved their stuff, but I hadn't made the link that... I definitely hadn't made a link that I was trying to join their thing.
I see, okay.
When I did the pantomime.
Yes.
Once this other thing happened, where there was auditions for this proper thing that goes up to Edinburgh, and I was 24 at the time. I had no prospects in other areas, and I had time, and I was living in Cambridge. Then it suddenly felt like, oh, hang on a minute. I think I'm quite close to doing with one more sort of good audition and getting into this thing. I think I then have quite a good 6 months ahead of me where it might be really an interesting thing to do. And I didn't know what would happen after that, but that point I was thinking, yeah, this is... I wasn't really thinking, you know, of the whole, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants
thing. Okay.
But at that point I was thinking, yeah, this looks like a really interesting thing to do.
Because a quality that you have at the moment that is, I think, that really kind of comes out through all of your work is you are kind of impish. You're impish within a kind of a deliberate sort of not fusty exactly, but do you know what I mean? You're like, you're when I see you on stage, you're often wearing and I've got that sort of early memory of you wearing a suit with a can of lager and your arm in a sling.
Sure.
And you're sort of schlubby, which is a word I've stolen from Mark Kermode that I don't entirely know what it means.
Right, yeah.
But you're twinkly and impish within that.
Yeah.
So were you, like, how much does that... It does, it reflects your actual personality, because I know you socially a little bit.
Yeah.
And you're impish. So were you at the time, because the way you're describing it now, and we're sort of talking in very serious terms, yeah, right, yeah, as a result of being in the nerve center.
Oh, totally, yeah.
But
it was entirely an impish thing. It was
because you weren't just stumbling in going, well, I've got no prospects. You were thinking, hang on, I could blag this and it might be quite fun.
Yeah. I also was quite aware at the time that it was quite a fun thing that was happening.
Okay.
You know, and obviously, I had that thing which I had, because I lived in Cambridge, I wasn't studying there. So there was a lot of funny things happening because I was living a double life. I was temping at the time.
Okay.
So by day, I'd be temping. I'd sometimes have to wriggle out of things. I'd sometimes...
You'd have to invent lectures and stuff.
Yeah,
so
I'd sometimes... yeah. I didn't have to do much lying, but... I almost never lied because it was you don't
once, once you're in the hive.
Yeah, because you don't have to you don't have to lie. You know.
Yeah.
You know. No one would ever say, "Hang on a minute, are you not a student?" Any more than I would say, "Hang on a minute, have you actually got a podcast?"
Yeah.
Was this sort of?
I mean, that really does throw this into a very interesting light.
Yeah. But no, that was like it was really there was a lot of there was a lot of impishness floating about.
Okay.
Because, it, you know, it just it felt quite funny at times because I would be leaving my job as a threshold assessment regional deployment officer and cycling through Cambridge, often quite fast, getting to the rehearsal.
Okay.
And sort of being late. And but again, no one would say, oh, well, if, did you have, was your lecture late? Also, I think I was playing the part of someone who was, I think I was a PhD student. So I think they have to, I think they maybe have to do lectures a bit and stuff, I think.
Okay, you were different. You, your cover story was sufficiently different.
Look, my cover story was that I was doing a PhD in... Nikolai Gogol.
Okay, okay.
Was what it was. And one time someone asked me about the government inspector because they'd just been cast in it. And I said, I don't know. I'm my focus is mainly his short stories.
And then sort of, such a good lie.
Genuinely did say that. I'm still friends with him. That's Sam. But yeah, that was one of very few. There was another time where I had to... The rehearsal room was in my college. I'd obviously had to assign myself a college in my backstory. I mean, my backstory was so thin. I think I just had a college. I had a name. I used my own name. Had a college. Had a bike. That was my own bike. I had, other than that, I had a working knowledge of Nikolai Gogol, and kept quiet that I was a temp.
Presumably, the steps have been taken to ensure this can never happen again.
Well, I hope not. I mean, it kind of felt. I mean, if I'd announced it and all of the other five had gone, yeah, me too. Then that would have felt like we'd all really hosed down the current students. But I was always quite. I could always square it off in my mind that also they often had five people doing it, and that year they had six. So I kind of always took myself as being the sixth person.
Yeah, okay.
And that made me feel less bad. Like the people that the only people for me that. Could be disappointed would be someone who would be the sixth if it wasn't me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not even necessarily sure that would have happened. I think that they could easily have had five and stuff. So, no, I've definitely ruined someone's life. No, but I haven't. I kind of felt like, I also feel like, I didn't make it any worse. I wasn't like, I think there's probably bad imposters and good imposters. It was a fun thing, you know, and we're all still friends, like the people who are in it.
I mean, presumably you or someone is trying to turn this into a film or has tried in the past.
I think and I'm trying
good
to
good imposters
about
and
it.
Bad imposters would seem like a workable title.
The good imposter. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so there was a time where it was in my college, the rehearsal, and so someone else from the cast said that she didn't know where that place was, so she'd meet me at the Porter's Lodge and then we'd go there. So I was walking along with her very casually talking about, you know, passing the time of day and walking confidently towards where I thought must be this sort of area.
Oh my God.
And we just got to a massive gate that was locked and then I just sort of got there and sort of went, right, oh, of course, no, it's this, we're back here. Just looking around, and it's like, I think it was before mobiles. I don't think I had a mobile. Or did I? I don't know. It was 2000.
Yeah.
I've just had one. But yeah. It was, yeah, situations like that were occurring. But no, mainly it was, I don't know, yeah. But the impishness thing was that I obviously was living at home, and so all of my friends from home were my social life. So it was quite funny sort of reporting back and sort of going...
So they were all in on it?
I had an outlet, you know, it wasn't like...
I see, okay, yeah, that would make a difference, right.
So it was quite funny because I'd be saying, well, this is happening now, and now this has happened. And it wasn't like for a long period. I think started lying in about September and finished lying in about... Well, it was when we finished the script... And
yes. I remember hearing someone said to you, look, we found out what you're doing, but it's too late to recast you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, look, we want you to do it. And then, yeah, we finished. We then rehearsed and worked out how the thing was going to be. And then we all were assembled at his flat. And he said, Tim's got something he wants to say. And then I had to say it. It's quite.
And how did they take it?
They
must have loved it. Surely.
They enjoyed it. Right. Mark Watson was one of the people. Yes. And Mark sent me an email the next day comparing me to what's the guy called, Gary Crosby, who is the chap who in the late 80s, I think Andy Dibble had the ball. Who's a goalkeeper, and he was holding the ball, and Gary Crosby came around the back of him and headed it out of his hands. And scored. Impish.
Impishly. Yes, right.
Almost the definition of impishness.
I'd like to talk about your relationships with Mark and with Alex, because they're that sort of, again, around the time I sort of first got to know you was, I don't know, it's all a bit of an Edinburgh blur in many ways, but yeah. It's definitely with We Need Answers, and I know you're in Horn's Latin show.
Yeah.
Were you in that before or after you were in Cowards?
Oh, before. I mean, Alex's first thing was, his first solo show was 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just lack of prospects, current prospects, meant that he did his show. Well, Alex was always a brilliant comedian, but I think he'd probably been doing it for a few years, and he was going to do his first Edinburgh show. And I went and watched the first preview, and he had an assistant who was Al Doyle, who is weirdly in Hot Chip now.
Okay.
So, yeah, he literally, Al Doyle said, I don't know whether I can do Edinburgh because my band are starting to do quite well.
Oh, my God, that's great.
Yeah.
Hot Chip is particularly appropriate for a friend of Alex's.
I feel it's really good, yeah. And so he went off to do his, you know, his pipe dream of this stupid little band. And so Alex then asked me if I would do that role.
Okay.
Which was it was a very enjoyable thing to do. It was basically Alex's solo show with a guy behind him on acetates with an overhead projector.
So early Horn technology. Really, okay.
A kind of a perfect storm version of Horn.
Yes.
Really. I mean, it's very nice. I mean, Horn went on to, I mean, I'm sure there's more to his career, but it's a master PowerPoint.
Yeah, I mean, he really did master it.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of shows of Alex's, there'd be a combination of people coming up to him and saying, I really love that, that was really funny, and other people saying, tell me that wasn't PowerPoint. just pushing the boundaries of comedy.
And your relationship to Alex in it, on stage, is you're kind of a maverick element. Is that right?
Well, that's the thing. With that show, it was really like that. That Alex was... I just was watching this stand-up show every night, which was great. It was a show about comedy, about laughter,
mm-hmm.
where Alex had found an old academic tome about what makes people laugh and went through the chapters, which is kind of very, again, like a perfect storm in terms of Alex's vibe,
mm-hmm.
and a bit of source material he can use. Yeah, it's perfect. So he would do that, and I just had like a hotel bell at my desk and a mic. And so, I mean, it was the most unbalanced double act you'll ever see.
So you'd literally just have an interrupting bell.
Yeah, so I'd say it was a double act where it was maybe 85%, 15% was what we were working on. And also in terms of just everything. It's not like in Penn and Teller where they at least stood next to each other. I was miles behind him. So I'd just sit there and do my thing. But yeah, you're right. There was like an element of I was at liberty to do all the stuff that was in the show. But then if I spotted something that was, you know, potentially could take us somewhere, then I'd be able to do it. And I guess that's at that point that happened quite a lot, where I'd just be sort of behind Alex or behind Mark as well in Mark's 24-hour show.
Yes,
similar thing where Mark would be, you know, freewheeling and, you know, absolutely ruling it, and it's his show. I'd say in both examples I've just sort of been someone who's been there, but in their show.
Yeah, and does that give you... That must surely give you sort of an incredible amount of licence. Like, there's no pressure on you to be funny, but you can just seize every opportunity.
Yeah,
and leap in.
But again, only if it is going well. If you've leapt in four or five times and it's fallen flat four or five times, then you still sort of get quite a sweaty forehead and start thinking, oh, Christ, he didn't need me, so why am I here?
Yes, okay.
So you still feel like even if you are trying to justify being 15% of the situation, you've still got to make the 15%.
Yes.
But like with Alex's show, you have the advantage of lots of stuff that he's written, so you're always in it. And with Mark's show, you have the advantage of it's 24 hours. So it's kind of perfectly okay. You can have a quiet couple of hours.
Yes. So your contribution, your kind of interruptive style in those shows seems to make use of one of the things you're brilliant at, which is that you're really good, I think, at getting things wrong. You've got a really good I don't know if it's a natural inclination towards it, or like for comic effect, or whether it's more cerebral. But I remember going to shake your hand a couple of years ago, and you just shook my hand wrong and just ended up climbing on me.
Oh dear.
And I remember thinking, no, it was fantastic, but it really made me laugh. I was just in a sort of fun social way. But I remember thinking, oh, that's something kind of clicked into place. I went, oh, that's what Tim's really good at. He's just like, I went to shake your hand and you sort of misunderstood on purpose and ended up clambering on me.
Right, right.
And I'm just wondering if there's a sort of a line to be drawn.
I think
there.
There's definitely a point to be made there, but I think you're making it much better than I could. But yeah, you're probably right. There is something, yeah. I guess it's just playing the fool, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I think at the moment, everyone, it seems, is going to Goliath. Right? Everyone's right, yeah, this French, I keep saying it now, but I've got to credit it to Alfie Brown, calling it the French Awards School. Loads of more comics, and I won't say their names, perhaps they'd rather keep it secret, but interesting comics that I think of as cerebral, interesting comics.
Yeah.
A couple of them in the last month have both said, oh, I'm going to go and do a little course at Goliath.
Wow.
Now, you've never done anything like that, or kind of clowning training or anything like that, but you do seem to have a natural appreciation for the opportunities for things to go wrong, do you think?
Maybe, and maybe that is, maybe that does help, that doing all those things with Alex and with Mark, where you just get a lot of stage time and a lot of, like you say, a lot of license and building stuff on nothing, I suppose. I don't know what they do in that school, but I would imagine maybe it's conceivable there might be a class called something along those lines, where you just start with nothing and just...
As I understand it, it's a lot to do with that.
Yeah, right? Totally. And so I kind of think that in Mark's stuff, when me and Mark have worked together, but, you know, we're working together to make this stuff happen, but that's always the most fun thing, I think, when in those shows that he does, when something absolutely inconsequential happens and it becomes something. We did a thing where years ago in one of his shows, where just out of the delirium, there was a conversation. There was somehow we got into a bit where I was guessing his pin, and it went on for about 5 minutes. And I think people took about a couple of minutes to tune in, because I think they were just sort of, there was just this sort of, in that show, it sort of drifts this way and that. I don't know. And somehow, out of the ashes of the previous bit of nonsense that had happened, there was just this really important game going on, which was a bit like, what's the game where, is it Mastermind, where you have to get
the pegs?
The pegs,
yes.
And it was, we played it like that.
Ah, so if you got one number right, he'd tell you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it went on for ages. And, I guess that's it. It's like, that sort of thing is, I don't think you'd necessarily write it.
Yes.
And bring it along and... I mean, it took 5-10 minutes, but I think the idea of me and Mark pitching up to a comedy club and then bringing us on and us doing our pin bit,
yes,
wouldn't be appropriate.
But yes,
the fact
okay.
that it just was this thing where it hadn't—we never done it, we never talked about that, we never talked about it since. But yeah, in the moment, it was very funny, and crucially, I think though neither of us were laughing, both of us found the situation really enjoyable.
Yes.
And really funny.
So there is something about following... Like, are you trying to make him laugh?
I think always that's another factor in doing their shows is... I mean, obviously, there's going to be some collateral that the audience will enjoy it, but otherwise you wouldn't be asked to do it. But, yeah, I think with both of them, there's no sort of finer reflection on how well it's going than Alex laughing. Want to do the horn section as well?
Yes.
If I do the horn section, that's the idea, is to go on and just do something where the band have really enjoyed it.
Yes, of course it is.
And then... then everything else looks after itself. I'm not saying that I'm always good at that. You know, I'm like any comedian where sometimes you feel really, you know, bulletproof and able to do these things. And other times you sort of think, well, forget about the band. I need to get out of here alive and just do my best stuff. And but, you know, that as a basic rule of thumb, same with Mark's show is... The idea for me is to sort of say something where Mark is then laughing, and then that will mean that because pretty much that's a pretty good divining rod, lightning rod for it to go through. That if Mark thinks it's a funny thing, then it will have that kind of effect in the room. That
yes,
people will enjoy that.
And is there an equivalent that you could articulate? About, or is there an equivalent? Can you pick up that idea and take it into a solo show? Is it just you trying to make the audience laugh? Well, or is there an equivalent whereby you're trying to... I mean, the dumbest one would be like, are you trying to make the tech laugh?
Oh, yeah. Well, I used to, definitely.
Oh, with Fletch and Dougie as well, yeah.
But no, the obvious point about me trying to make Mark laugh or trying to make Alex laugh is that effectively it's saying stuff that I would find funny.
Yes.
So I don't think it's ever healthy to second guess, you know, an audience. But I suppose I wouldn't really be second guessing Mark or Alex in the same way as anyone down the pub who thinks of saying something in a social situation that is very funny.
Yes, okay.
They're not thinking this should work for Claire and Keith.
Maybe they are.
Maybe, yeah. But if it's that thing of just finding something funny and then feeling at liberty to say it. And I guess that was kind of, yeah, that was a very, I never really analysed it, but yeah, it's a nice thing to have, you know, at that point when you're just sort of still scratching around and, you know, there's no, I don't think, for me anyway, I tried doing stand-up and I found it very, very difficult to unlock anything. Like it was a tough thing to do, but this is before I did poetry or anything like that. So to have a bit, however long, like two or three years later, where I didn't really worry so much about unlocking anything. I was just kind of able to sort of be relatively relaxed on stage. Mm. It's a real kind of godsend. I mean, it's kind of the Holy Grail in a way to be on stage and feel at liberty to sort of...
Yes.
At liberty for things to come into your mind and you be able to say them.
Yes.
Because you think they're funny. It's kind of... It's an amazing situation to get.
I just realised, actually, there's two parallels to be drawn there. One is that you've got the cards and the poems, so you can be in opposition with the poems.
Yeah, I used to do that much more. Like, right at the start, that was more or less it. It was a relationship between me and the poems.
And you treat them almost as if someone else has written them. You go...
Totally. Oh,
like that line we were saying before about Roy does such and such... Looks like we've underestimated Roy.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And I think it kind of goes in waves because I've done, like, written those little poems now for years. And so I think sometimes I play the opposite game of sometimes giving them more reverence than they're due. And there's probably some mileage in that direction as well.
Yes.
But so I totally agree. When I first started, I would be reading them and being disappointed in them.
Mm-hmm.
Not really disappointed in myself. And you're right, it's almost like someone had brought them to my desk that morning, and I knew that at 8 o'clock I had to read them out. And I'm like, well, oh God, and this is not great, is it?
Yes.
And I've got to be on stage for how
yes,
long?
Yes, yes. So
in front
you're
of how many people? And this is what I've got.
Yeah.
And so I'd go on.
You get to do a double act with your earlier self.
Yeah. So yeah, they're an interesting device to have. I mean, they are obviously at their heart a crutch.
Do you think so?
Well,
because surely they're a format which gives you the same license as you would have to interrupt and ding your bell at horn.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I at one point when I'd been doing it a while, I kind of reflected that I think I did a show about 3 years ago where I kind of thought, that's interesting, there's less poems in this one than in the last one.
Okay.
And I think they've been going that way for three shows in a row. And then I did sort of think, maybe that's how it'll be then. I'll jettison them ultimately and, like, stabilisers and, you know, sail off into the sunset with... as a proper comedian who doesn't need poems. And then I think it was while I was in the last one, I just thought, I don't ever really want to do that. I mean, I'm open to the idea of doing a show with none of them in, but I kind of like it. And it definitely is useful in that sense that you can just talk and talk either, you know, with an audience member or, you know, that's kind of improvised or some kind of anecdote or, you know, bit of stuff that you've got. But then when it ends, you have that possibility of just going to your breast pocket and pulling out some...
Yes, which means that you're always... safe isn't the word, because you're always at risk, but you're always calm because you can follow an idea, and if it dies, let's get a poem out.
Well, I used to do...
I think that's what I'm jealous of when I say I'm like, I'm at peak... wanting to be like Key.
Yeah.
I think it's a specific... There's a video of you online of you at Knock Two Bag.
Yeah.
Which is really... I just watched that one recently. And that is kind of... I think you're in the middle of that period of, you know, just like you just play music and come on and say nothing for ages because you know you've got all those jokes in your pocket.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but it kind of... Yeah, it goes in waves and stuff. But I think they're a very practical thing, really. I did stuff where I tried stand up, that didn't work, but I was kind of in like Starbucks in Soho with this sheet of my jokes, learning them. And I'm terrible at learning stuff, and I'd just be like covering them with a napkin, and then I'd do it, and you know, it's amazing. Like you don't finish your 5 minutes, and people come up to you and say, "Wow, how do you remember that stuff?" People either like it because it's funny or you live and die on whether it's funny.
Mm.
And to take that out of the equation almost completely, the first time I did poetry was really an amazing moment where you just kind of, you walk on and I just had it all in. I used to have it in notepads. That was how it was all around my body. But the first time I did it, it was a notepad.
Yes.
Because just gradually it's become more and more unmanageable. But at the start, everything I'd written was in one notepad. And so I just flick through these things. And I'd say things in between, but I wouldn't really have to remember what to say. I didn't really have any sort of prepared lines. Yeah. I just had these poems.
When you say you it became more unmanageable, presumably, again, that's you following an instinct of, I should do this worse. Do you know what I mean? Like having several different things? No?
No, but I remember that moment was I did it in... did it in 2007 with my first solo show doing poetry. And in that one, right up until that point, I'd had these pads when I'd go and do a show and I'd do 10, 15 minutes. It got, because I think I must have started about 2005. So at that point, I had maybe six notepads around my body. And they were just randomly placed. And I'd go on, I'd do my set, and I'd come off, and there was genuine jeopardy. I wouldn't know where things were.
Okay.
I'd take them out, I'd decline some poems, I'd spend time looking for one, I would get in an absolute muddle, but it would all be okay, and I'd also be drinking, and it would all make sense, as you say, like it was this kind of... it was bordering on a character, I think, then.
Yes.
Much more. I think, for heaven's sake, I think I burped once. It's terrible. I did one gig. It's not really to do with this, but I did one gig where I was drunk, really drunk, and I remember having to play him less drunk than I was because I wanted him to be how drunk.
Yes, yes, he needs to be tipsy despite you being drunk. Oh, God. It's
terrible. So I took that. I took a show then to Edinburgh with these six pads. And I did the first night, and it was that that night that you, you know, the sort of infamous night that everyone has where it just fell apart. I mean, it's terrible. And I didn't know where anything was. And the show, when it only gets to an hour, you have to have some kind of you have to know what you're doing a bit.
Mm.
And so I realised that I had to just fall on my sword, and it couldn't be that I didn't know where anything was. It had to be that I knew, I had to know what I was doing, roughly.
Mm.
I mean, and then I can, like, move away from it, but I had to know what I was doing. And so I went home, and I drew my suit, and I put a number on each pad.
Okay.
And I wrote down where they'd go.
Okay.
And then the next night...
I see, okay.
Notepad number 4, top left. Notepad number 5, top right. 1 and 2.
Okay.
In my trousers. And went on. And, you know, if you'd seen it one night and seen it the other night, you wouldn't have known the difference. You just said, well, the second one, it was better. But it would be because I now knew where things were.
Okay, okay.
And I don't really think I looked back after that in terms of... There's just so many. Like, they're my notepads there. And there's loads now. And when I first did it, there weren't that many. So it was quite a fun... it was quite a fun bit of play that was happening. And I think people knew as well. You know, in the audience, they're like, he hasn't got a clue where things are. Which is fun.
Yeah.
It's fun in the Albany and the Hen and Chickens.
Yes.
And it's less fun in the Pleasance when people have paid for an hour.
Yes.
Because then you know, you need to be in control of how it develops over an hour.
So there's a kind of a parallel lines of you, it needs to be unmanageable.
Yeah.
But manageable at the same time. It needs to be fun, but orchestrated to an extent.
Yeah, I think so. Like last night, I was on for like whatever 15 minutes, and I had some poems, and it doesn't need to be caressed in any way that it's more or less manageable than it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's about right. It's fine. I can get in a mess and get out of a mess. It's all fine. But to go to Edinburgh and do an hour,
yeah,
you know, you want. That's why there's now like a structure on my pinboard. You know, you want the show to work as a show. You want to go through some kind of ebb and flow, and you can do that over an hour more if you know where everything is.
Yes,
on your body.
So that was part one of Tim. Part two coming up next week. I've chatted to you loads on this episode, so I'll keep this very brief. My dear friend and brilliant comedian Tin and Duyeb has got a live DVD recording available online at tinanddueb.vhx.tv. I'm reliably informed as of Monday it'll be on his website too, which is tinanddueb.co.uk. Duyeb is D-O-U-I-E-B, and if you can get that right, I'm sure you can guess Tiernan. Tiernanddueb.co.uk. If you use the code COMCOMPOD, then you get a third off the price. It's only $2.99 anyway, which is about £1.70. So this would make it $1.99, which is less than that. Get yourself a COMCOMPOD special discount on Tiernan's video album there. He's a brilliant comedian and an incredibly positive force in comedy. Tiernan's one of those guys who cannot do enough for you and to make the world a better place for comedy. So thanks to Tiernan. And that's your special offer from tinandduyeb.co.uk. His first ever stand-up DVD is called This Isn't For You. And finally, and I'm very sad about this, I didn't want to open the show with this, but news has just reached me yesterday of the death of Sir Terry Pratchett, who was, I'm not kidding, an all-time hero of mine, and I would like to dedicate this episode to him. I really wish that I'd started this show a few years sooner and could have got him on and could have asked him on when he was still well. He was one of the funniest and wisest people, creative people we were lucky enough to have. If you've not read any of his books, and it's easy to be put off by the sort of noodly, wizardy kind of appearance of it, but they are actually beautiful and gentle and savage satires of the way the world is. So if sometimes you need to see past the wizards, I recognise you're not all into wizards and goblins, but there's so much there to find. I recommend them to anyone. I would start with Good Omens, which he co-wrote with Neil Gaiman, who's another one of my very favourite authors. And if you like it, get cracking on Discworld. So RIP Sir Terry Pratchett. I am much saddened by your death and I am really, I'm really pleased to see how much love there is for you pouring out all over the world. So thank you for everything, Sir Terry. Thanks very much. I'll speak to you soon.